three solving big problems, one petabyte at a time. A VTapestry podcast recorded for Creative Disturbance on April 15th, 2015. Big dreams,
big data.
I'm Rebecca Nix.
I'm Christine Maxwell.
And together we are VTapestry. Happy Earth Day, Christine. It's definitely springtime in Texas again, and it's great to see so many folks enjoying the outdoors already. Now that I teach completely online, I really miss taking students around the UTD campus to practice field sampling or digital curation with new apps like iNaturalist. One of my favorite workshops was a day-long excursion to a local preserve where I set up comparisons between the traditional testing protocols and just-released mobile sensors and probes from Pasco Scientific. The dissolved oxygen test results were greatly improved in terms of speed and accuracy, which left more time for exploring. After another drought-stricken summer, I've been thinking about how what you and I are exploring from a technology standpoint relates back to the real world in terms of the natural environment. I'd like to talk more about that today, with a focus on how new ways of thinking and doing can re-energize our generation and encourage our students to seek out ways to discover new pathways for our immediate present and our uncertain future. As a science educator, I've always felt a strong connection to the Earth, and I'm glad that technology continues to be a valuable tool in understanding our universe. But I worry about how the next generation relates. As you know, my professional pathway has always aligned closely with my personal story. Like you, I think we grew up during the best of times, when our mothers could get away with locking us outside for a few hours each day. And they did just that. While we had new technologies and found them interesting, they were still novelties or gadgets back in the 60s and 70s. With today's kids spending an average of 44 and a half hours per week in front of screens, sometimes two or more at a time, it all seems like one big global obsession now.
Well, I find it really scary to think of, you know, little tiny tots literally sitting with their eyes glued to a screen from the age of only several months, which I've actually seen myself. Particularly in the last two decades, it really feels like childhood has kind of moved indoors. The average boy and girl spends as few as 30 minutes in unstructured outdoor play each day, and yet more than 7 hours each day in front of an electronic screen. The challenge is that this shift inside really does have profound impact on the wellness of kids. In America, childhood obesity, for example, it's more than doubled in the last 20 years. And the United States has also become the largest consumer of ADHD medications in the world. That's really horrific. Pediatric prescriptions for antidepressants have also risen. So, you know, when I think of the issues of health and development, it seems that most children are missing out on the very essential connection to our natural world because they're not outside nearly enough. And that's a very important point. If we look on a planetary scale, the simulations and visualizations that scientific researchers are studying on those various screens hold amazing promise for global citizens to work together to solve, in many cases, continuously resolve today's serious environmental issues. So big data is definitely making a big difference in that regard and can certainly improve our understanding of the overall situation.
That's exactly what piqued my interest in this burgeoning field that merges science, technology, the arts, and more importantly, policy in this case. As an education, I'm excited about how big data tools and techniques can be used to objectify the messy problems we'd all prefer to ignore, in this case, regarding what's happening to our planet. An MSNBC clip of shocking images of California's landmarks before and after the drought began clearly shows that our habitat is changing. It can be quite depressing, but Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone pegged my big dream for realizing the potential of big data in their 2012 book, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. I had never thought about the fact that, quote, the word hope has two different meanings. The first involves hopefulness, where our preferred outcome seems reasonably likely to happen. If we require this kind of hope before we commit ourselves to an action, our response gets blocked in areas where we don't rate our chances too high. The second meaning is about desire, knowing what we hope for and what we'd like or love to take place. It is what we do with this hope that really makes the difference. Passive hope is about waiting for external agencies to bring about what we desire. Active hope is about becoming active participants and bringing about what we hope for. Active hope is a practice. It is something we do rather than have. It is a process we can apply to any situation. And that's where big data really might just help us to save our planet. Here's an example I think we can all appreciate. MIT researchers have shown smarter programming of stoplights can cut greenhouse emissions, while reducing the frustration of sitting in traffic during rush hour, too. Two papers published in Transportation Science and Transportation Research describe how they combined vehicle-level data with less precise but more comprehensive city-level data on traffic patterns to produce better information than current systems provide. While existing programs can simulate both city-scale and driver-scale practice, the challenge in this case was integrating the two behaviors. The MIT team figured out how to reduce the amount of detail to make the computations practical, while still retaining enough specifics to make useful predictions and recommendations. This success touches on some of the complexities of leveraging the masses of data we've already collected, though, doesn't it, Christine?
It sure does.
Scaling complex query processing techniques to terabytes while enabling interactive response times is a major open research problem today.
Well, it definitely is, but I have to say that advances in computing power, of course, but coupled with the incorporation of natural language and semantic search capabilities, have made it possible really to move far beyond what we've all known for so many years as the simple Boolean keyword searches of early research. Of course, today, Google is using predictive search capabilities and advanced functionalities, and those are enabling the answering of what they term conversational queries. Other search solutions are already enabling distributed searching across dispersed information repositories, and it's really cool that some can genuinely handle doing searching both into structured databases and unstructured data at one and the same time. However, the crowning caveat really is the challenge of scalability being handled at the same time as high levels of speed and high levels of accuracy. It's very, very difficult as a goal to achieve all those together. In fact, if you look at the Gartner Magic Quadrant that examines the competitive market for advanced analytics platforms, you can see that it's a sparse competitive field compared to its Magic Quadrant for business intelligence and analytics alone. And that's primarily because only a very few companies have created a highly scalable environment that's dynamic along with all of their other bells and whistles. Simply put, the challenge is to reach all kinds of data types in real time in order to analyze all the relevant data found within a single continuous view. Analyzing it, that's what big data is really all about. Unless you can connect what matters to you in ways that make sense to you, it's just more data. Machine learning, form of artificial intelligence, does allow applications to learn from what you ask about the data. Often, I'd have to say that now in your own conversational questions is beginning to happen. So that's the good news. And there is available today, in fact, as I said, software that is able to handle these ubiquitous big data challenges.
I'd like to bring up another variation on this theme. Following on with our attempt to define big data, which just keeps getting bigger and bigger, I was intrigued by a presentation on big data and the future for ecology that referenced challenges at scales individuals can't address. Long story short, the team made the point that collectively, ecologists may have big data, but they just aren't using it. Their study explored how dark ecology's dark data really is today, in terms of observatories, remote sensing, and citizen science data, for example. In a 2013 article of the same title, those authors note that, quote, ecologists already have big data to bolster the scientific effort, a large volume of distributed, high-value information, end quote. A question whether or not ecologists will join the larger scientific community in global initiatives to address major scientific and societal problems by bringing their distributed data to the table and harnessing its collective power. In a nutshell, this is how they summarize their call to action for traditional researchers. Ecologists collectively produce large volumes of data through diverse individual projects, but lack a culture of data curation and sharing, so that ecological data are missing from the landscape of data-intensive science. To fully take advantage of scientific opportunities available in the information age, ecologists must treat data as an enduring product of research and not just as a precursor to publications. And that forward-thinking ecologists will organize and archive data for posterity, publicly share their data, and participate in collaborations that address large-scale questions.
I think I have to say, you know, when you talked about Joanna Macy, that I do appreciate her pointing out that trying out, you know, a different way of thinking about our situation, meaning, you know, the sustainability of the Earth, it's a powerful way of strengthening our resilience and creativity. I'm really very enthusiastic about the huge take-up in citizen science. Citizen science, what I mean there, is it's referring to data collection and interpretation made by science enthusiasts rather than trained scientists, or enthusiasts who work alongside trained scientists. I think what draws people to participate in getting involved in these activities themselves, it's because very often when those activities can be local projects where you can really feel a tangible impact is going to be possible and that the benefits can happen to the local community and could be visibly seen and felt. Another example that comes to my mind of big data is the Large Hadron Collider. It's at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, known as CERN. It has 150 million sensors and created 22 petabytes of data in 2012. In biomedicine, the Human Genome Program is determining the sequences of the 3 billion chemical base pairs that make up human DNA. In Earth observation, there are over 200 satellites in orbit, and they're continuously collecting data about the atmosphere and the land, the ocean, the ice surfaces of planet Earth, with pixel sizes that range from 50 centimeters to many tens of kilometers.
That's probably part of what Angel Hugh is talking about in an AAAS interview about big data and the environment. When asking what ways he sees big data within that field changing or growing in the near future, he said, "I think the environmental policymakers and decision makers need to get more creative in thinking about how to generate big data for the environment. Trees can't tweet, and oceans can't create a census of species that live beneath their surface. So until then, we've got to get creative about how we can generate the necessary information and knowledge to make the smart policies and decisions that aren't ad hoc. Even though we talk a lot about the need to bridge together disciplines and actors, it's still not being done well enough in environmental policy." End quote. Big data clearly can contribute to our understanding of Earth systems today. There's no way that we can personally fix the mess our world is in, but the process of healing and recovering at a planetary level can happen through each of us becoming aware and making micro decisions to help save our planet for future generations. The value of technology in addressing the environmental question really boils down to a matter of time. That's the urgency. As Macy went on to frame it, in agricultural societies, the year's rhythm is counted in seasons. In the days before clocks, the sun moving across the sky gave shape to the day. Compare these natural cycles with the time intervals of modern technology, now measured in fractions of a microsecond. Life has become a race in a way that is historically unprecedented. The reason I'm so taken with the TerraMar project is because Ghislaine Maxwell's passion, combined with her expertise, literally has built a truly innovative technology framework that provides the latest and greatest information that can lead to meaningful insights and important action that drives policy decisions, say, by the United Nations. I'm proud that my own Teacher Development Center, through the School of Interdisciplinary Studies, was able to share her amazing story in an archive public seminar at UT Dallas. 13 minutes into that presentation, she stated that part of the problem here is that we don't have enough data. We don't have enough information on the high seas. We don't have enough information on the oceans. At 16 minutes, she said it again. How can we make good decisions if we don't have a lot of information? Knowledge is power. Data is key. So we need more information. I agree with Ghislaine and accept that the time is now for seriously big data.
Yeah. And you know, Rob Foos, who's the Director of Development for the TerraMar project, he effectively explained how a sense of urgency can really help us solve environmental issues. He puts it this way: creating a sense of urgency, whether artificial or actual, is a powerful force to further any cause. I think it results from a mixture of Parkinson's law. Work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. The procrastinator's favourite. Wait until the last minute and it will take only a minute to do. And FOMO, the recently popularised and surprisingly poignant slogan from Verizon's NFL commercials. Fear of missing out. When provided an opportunity to take some action, whether it's to donate, to sign a pledge, to buy a product, you name it, without an impending deadline, many people will take the time to further evaluate the chance, which means they'll likely not return. So introducing a sense of urgency and the concoction resulting from Parkinson's law and FOMO produces surprising results. The ability to delay the decision doesn't exist. So the people who weren't going to take any action in the first place are going to move on. But those that may take action are now forced, whether artificially or actually, to make that decision on the spot. No more procrastinating. And now conversions improve. This is actually played out every day right before our very eyes. Think of any of the millions of commercials saying, while supplies last, this weekend only, or any number of other phrases. The supposed discount or coupon isn't what's getting you in the door. It's the fear of missing out on the ability to use it. So how does this apply to the environment, and specifically the ocean? An actual deadline is approaching. It's no artificial sense of urgency here. The United Nations is deliberating their sustainability priorities for the next 15 years, called the Sustainable Development Goals. Replacing the successful implementation of the Millennium Development Goals, which Bill Gates lauded as the best idea for focusing the world on global poverty that he's ever seen. This opportunity comes at a time when there's a rare convergence of technology, environmental need, and political will. The time has never been better for meaningful change for the ocean and our planet. If we don't take action, if we don't make the ocean a priority now, it will be too late in 15 years. This very real sense of urgency is why the Terramar project is gaining momentum. Our mission is to build a global community to give a voice to the most ignored, least explored part of the planet, the ocean, and specifically the high seas. We are diligently advocating for the ocean's inclusion in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals because, at the end of the day, if the ecosystem that comprises 71% of the planet, the ocean, and specifically that part of the ocean called the high seas and international waters, which are ruled by no nation but owned by all, 45% of the planet. If the ocean isn't included in these goals, the damage done in the next 15 years may very well be irreversible or come at so significant a price that it may be politically impossible. This is the only Earth we've got. There is no planet B.
Well, that's exactly why I went to the Terramar website and took the I Love the Ocean pledge. Again, I come back to John Muir's statement, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. The connected learning movement in K-12 education may open the door for today's students to solve these new problems in new ways. It advocates for broadened access to learning that is socially embedded, interest-driven, and oriented toward educational, economic, or political opportunity. Connected learning is realized when a young person is able to pursue a personal interest or passion with the support of friends and caring adults, and is in turn able to link this learning and interest to academic achievement, career success, or civic engagement. This model is based on evidence that the most resilient, adaptive, and effective learning involves individual interest as well as social support to overcome adversity and provide recognition. That's what the Terramar Project, in my opinion, has done so well, to pull together the vetted resources that a classroom teacher or a parent or guardian can use to encourage their children, their students, to think and to come up with these creative solutions. A few years ago, I challenged my students to teach paperless with me. Continued advances in cloud computing have allowed me to go paperless in almost every area of my daily life. This year, I'm actively challenging everyone I know to take the free and easy I Love the Ocean pledge at the Terramar Project website. Through the efforts of the Terramar Project, one can truly amplify the voice of the ocean by being the voice of the ocean with just a click. You can make a difference through passion, creativity, and harnessing knowledge that can help to stall climate change on a global scale. It is clear that each of us can take responsibility to do our own thing to help, because it all adds up.
I think it genuinely does. Again, I think of Joanna Macy. She puts the possibilities of big data into a realistic perspective. Imagining possible futures is a surefire way to develop foresight. If we're only interested in facts, we limit ourselves to looking at what has already happened. And that's a bit like trying to drive a car by looking only in the rearview mirror. To avoid crashing, we need to look where we're going. Since we can't know for sure what will happen, we're limited to considering possibilities based on applying a combination of experience, awareness of trends, and imagination. While experience equips us well for dealing with familiar situations, our imagination is essential in formulating creative responses to new and yet unimagined challenges. Dr. Nix and I implore those who have listened to this podcast now to think more creatively, constructively, and critically than ever before about how today's big data tools and analytical techniques can be leveraged to improve the quality of life for all, including planet Earth, from whatever topic fuels your passion.
Thanks for listening today.
You can find out more at vtapestry.com.
Bye for now.